And you spoke about the Quaker tradition, and a lot of what the factory had was, it was self-sufficient in a way that if somebody got sick, they could go to the dispensary.
Indeed.
They had a dentist, they had a swimming pool. What was the idea of the swimming pool?
Well, I think it was to promote the health, cleanliness, recreational life of their workers, you know, to keep... They had this relatively benevolent attitude to their workers. Now, that's not to say that the pay was any better than the other business, but they had a lot of benefits, like a canteen where food was relatively inexpensive. They had the swimming pool. They had a roof garden for recreation purposes on the roof of the Bishop Street premises. They had sporting organisations associated with them, you know, all of that. As one of the ex-employees told me when I was talking to him, he put it very, very well. He said, "Oh, yeah, the Jacobs were great. They'd give you anything except money," you know. So I thought it was a good way of putting it.
What about the class, the school that they had
the school,
there.
Yeah.
What was the...
Well, again, education, you know, was a very much a tenet of Quaker belief, you know. Now, again, it was limited, because they only took boys to sort of do general work around the factory, as far as I understand it, and then they had to leave when they were 18. You know, so I think they sent them to maybe a half day a week to their school, you know, to learn the rudiments, I suppose.
Were they all the basic subjects?
I think so. I think so. Now, I'm not 100% sure. I imagine so. And, of course, then I'm not sure if the women went at all. I could be wrong. But then again, the women, once they married, they had to leave too. You know?
Did the women have a sewing class there as well?
Oh, they could very well. It wouldn't surprise me one bit. No, I honestly don't know, but they had all... I mean, it was such a large number. I mean, at the height of their business work, their business organisation there, say just before the First World War, when they had a huge amount of lines of... biscuits, brands of biscuits, not brands, but different types of assortments of biscuits. They had a huge variety. And that was quite labour intensive. It was after the First World War and into the 20th century when they became heavily mechanised. And to make it efficient with your big machinery, you have to streamline the number of varieties, you know, the number of lines of biscuits you had. But at the height of their operation, when they weren't terribly mechanised, there was anything up to 3,000. People working there on the premises, most of them women.
When you say there was a big variety of different biscuits, could you go?
Fascinating, and it's amazing the way the biscuit names kind of reflect their time. For instance, Mikado, I think it arose around the time of the Gilbert and Sullivan opera of the same name. Kimberley, around the time of the Boer War, when the Kimberley diamond mines were big into, big in the news and all of that, you know. So they had a huge variety. And, of course, these were all sold unwrapped. You know, they were in vacuum-packed packages then. You had an open box with a lid on it, a transparent lid, and you'd pick this and pick that. You know, you had it all mixed by the shopkeeper.
Other names.
Oh, yeah.
Marshmallow.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Now, it's interesting. Well, no, I'm not sure, but it's interesting that when I was talking to a lot of the people in management and some of the employees, that they pointed out to me that the Irish taste in biscuits was quite different to the English taste in biscuits. That the Irish were heavy into the mallow-type biscuits, you know, Kimberley's coconut creams, Mikado, which have a mallow element to them. And this was very popular in Ireland. Now, it's like the duck and the egg, or the hen and the egg, is it? Whatever. You know, whether these became popular because Jacob started making them, or there was some sort of demand, I don't know, there was a demand there already, you know, for them. But apparently, the mallow-type biscuit was their big thing. Also, of course, as they keep telling us, they invented the cream cracker, you know. What happened was, around the maybe 1910, 20, around that period, beginning of the 20th century, they noticed that a type of biscuit which hadn't been seen before was coming into the country from places like Canada, of all places. This was a biscuit that wasn't sweet.
Yeah.
It's kind of savoury. You could put cheese on or something like that, you know, maybe a little salad type thing, you know. So they began to get worried about this. So one of them actually went on an industrial espionage expedition to America to suss out these cracker type biscuits. And he came back with all sorts of recipes to try. They tried one or two, they didn't succeed, until eventually the cream cracker was tried, and this was a huge success. And that was their biggest seller. In fact, as far as I know, it still is, believe it or not, their biggest seller.
All those biscuits needed produce and good management and good bakers. The recipes, where did they arrive
Well,
from?
I think they made them up themselves, I think, you know, most of them. And they had they have recipe books in their archive, you know.
Yeah.
Quite a number of recipe books.
So those recipes would have gone back long ago.
I think so. Because I'm sure many of them, once they were successful, they wouldn't have changed an awful lot, you know. The big concern was the ovens, really. The ovens were of prime importance. And for any sort of efficiency, you needed long tunnel-like ovens. These weren't ovens where you just put everything in and took them back out the same door. These were what they called travelling ovens, what we'd call a conveyor belt type operation. So they'd have big long ovens with a conveyor belt going, steel conveyor belt going through them, and at one end they'd put the unbaked dough, you know, shaped into the biscuit form, and then they would travel through the long oven for the required amount of time, you know, to be in contact with the heat and come out baked at the far end.
Mm.
So you could keep the operation going, you know, there was no stopping and going, just this kept going night and day, you know. And the longer the conveyor belt could be, the better, because the more efficient it was. So they had to, for instance, I'm told that they had a sloping oven, you know, to give more length to, because you need a very long factory if you're going to. So they hadn't space. In fact, they were constricted in the end in Bishop Street. But they devised a sloping oven. The problem with a sloping oven is that, of course, all the heat tended to go to the top.
Yeah.
So they devised a system of fans and all that. And they kind of invented a lot of the machinery, you know, that went with large-scale biscuit production that was taken up by other companies in different parts of the world after that, you know.
That's extraordinary. And so a lot of the, when you were researching for this book, did you find where the produce was coming from?
Well, the native ingredients, flour, for instance, was coming from Ireland. However, the Irish flour wasn't always suitable. Now, again, I'm not a technical person on flour, but they tell me that a lot of the Irish flour would have to be mixed with flour, say, from the United States or Canada.
Yeah.
So they used Irish flour, but they had to import a lot of, I think there's something to do with softness or something like that. They had to import a lot of flour from Canada, the United States, and the Great Prairies in the United States, just producing, you know, just limitless amounts of flour. So it was relatively cheap, I would think. Now, however, they were sourcing all their dairy produce, you mean butter, milk, you know, all of that was coming from Irish firms. And then more exotic products like the basic ingredients for the chocolate, like cocoa and all of that would be imported, nuts from places like Brazil and countries like that.